welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. I am here today with a great group of discussants to talk about European public procurement and the role it can play in the green transition. I've got two colleagues who have just published a paper on that and held an event to discuss it. They are Francesco Nicoli and Marie Lapa. And we are joined from Lithuania by Karolis Granickas, who is the head of Europe for Open Contracting Partnership. And we will be diving into how governments buy stuff in Europe at the EU level, at the national level, at the local level. How does that work? And can that be used to help Europe meet its transition goals? Francesco, tell us about your paper. Why did you do this and what did you find?
Hi. So thanks for the opportunity to delve into this a bit more in detail. We decided to investigate the issue of introducing green criteria into public procurement because the green transition is one of the strategic goals of the European Union. An enormous political and economic capital is being invested in ensuring that the European Union meets its very ambitious targets in terms of decarbonization, but the public sector represents a huge part of the European economy and therefore impacting and changing the way the public sector purchases services and goods is essential if the EU is to meet its own targets. At a European level, a number of reforms are being undertaken, but of course these reforms are in tension with other goals that the European Union is pursuing in terms of strategic autonomy, in terms of economic stability and budgetary stability of various countries. So in the paper, we investigate not only the policies that the Commission is putting forward, but also the tensions with these other goals, and we try to offer solutions on how to address this underlying trilemma between stability, the green transition, and of course, strategic autonomy.
Marie, what were the most interesting findings of your study, and what would you like people to take away from it?
So we looked at this from a lot of different avenues, like Francesco already mentioned. We were actually struggling to find a lot of good data, which is also a big topic in this space when discussing public procurement, because there is actually no comprehensive database or an overview that is comparable across different EU countries. And that in and of itself, I actually found quite surprising that there is a lot of policy discussions around this. There's a lot of decisions to be taken. And it is actually quite difficult to make a very informed decision in terms of what is the current situation. So Francesco mentioned this green public procurement, so introducing these green criteria into the process. And there's actually not even a comprehensive overview of how much of it is already done. So it is possible under current rules to introduce these criteria. Some countries do this, but there is no common definition, for example, or there's also no comprehensive overview, for example, how much percent of contracts are actually already green. So that I actually found quite surprising because it's such a big topic. And I think sometimes you should start at the basics and see where we are. And that's actually quite a clouded picture.
Do either of you think that this is something that we can address holistically, or do we need to tease it out into the different levels? Because I imagine that a town hall buying office supplies is a lot different from a government buying a power plant.
So at the moment, the rules, more than differentiating between the levels of government, they differentiate on the size of the contracts, regardless of which entity or contracting authority is putting the contract forward. All sorts of government entities have a lot of freedom when it comes to small contracts, especially because the oversight and competition rules allow authorities to be more flexible on small contracts. On the other side, large contracts need to be very open at European level. They need to be accessible to all possible entities across the EU. And in turn, this means that the oversight and rules are much stricter. This said, different countries have different approaches to how to include green and social criteria in contracting. Karolis probably will tell us a lot more about this. And this fragmentation of the way of implementing social and green contracting at national level creates important administrative burdens for companies, which cannot really claim they can move easily from one country to the other, because even though the principles are shared, the actual implementation of these principles is so different that basically is a new challenge every time a company decides or wants to apply for a contract cross-border.
Yeah, and I think, so in terms of potential, at which level would it be helpful to introduce common rules? I think a big possibility here is, for example, common digital platforms. So this is really something that you can make accessible to every level of government. And by introducing common platforms, common standards, it's also easier to collect data, and also data that is comparable, of course.
And when you say digital platforms, you mean platforms for doing the contracting, or you mean when governments set up platforms for collecting data across their various industries?
Well, you can combine both. So basically in setting out a tender, so if governments or procuring authorities set out a tender, they can do so on public platforms. Firms apply to it, and the contract decision is based on different criteria that firms enter and whatnot. So it's a combination of both, and I guess that would also be the most efficient way to do this.
And what makes it green?
Well, the green part of it is in the criteria part, so in how governments select different firms or different offers that they have put out. And the big question of what makes it green is, like I said, there is currently no common definition. So it can range from some governments define it as in, if there's one green criteria in it, then it can be considered green. Others say it needs to have a wide range of criteria that it fulfills. So this also, because the variety or the public contracting is so broad in terms of what they buy, this could go from a building and using either sustainable materials, including things like life cycle costs, heating efficiency and whatnot, but also, like you mentioned as well, office supplies. So is it sustainably sourced paper, for example? So what is green is really a big question, in fact, and how to best apply it is actually quite complicated.
Thank you. Carolis, thank you again for joining us this morning from Lithuania. What does European procurement look like from your perspective? What does your shop do, and what are you hoping to get from the policy process?
Thank you, Rebecca. I'll start maybe with quickly reflecting on what Francesca and Marie did. I think it's a great work, by the way. I think what we're seeing right now is that since 2017, and way earlier, really, a lot of countries and the European Commission has said that, well, we have to do green procurement because it's a good idea. And that's really what it is, right? Because there were no metrics, there were no hard criteria, there were no mandates. So countries were allowed to do whatever they want and whatever, you know, however they chose to pursue those goals, right? So it was really almost like an ideological idea to use a lot of money, which is procurement, to help green transition. All right, that's great. So what we had then later is a COVID pandemic. Then we had a second Trump administration, which was a huge shock. And we all of a sudden became a bit more pragmatic about it, right? So if you imagine the triangle that Francesca and Marie puts out, which is a trilemma between strategic autonomy, price stability, and decarbonization, we are moving more into prioritizing strategic autonomy right now. So what I think will be happening with the policy shift right now is that we will say, okay, it does not have to be all green, but we have to create sectors, strategic sectors that have to be green, and we have to understand how to make those green criteria work for European businesses, especially in those strategic sectors. And I think that those are the discussions in the Parliament, is how can we use green procurement not as, let's say, a compliance-driven exercise that countries put out for their businesses to kind of adapt to, but really help our European businesses grow and gain that sustainable kind of strategic edge in the global market. And I think that is what's happening. And I think this trilemma approach is really helpful in understanding how the whole policy shift is moving towards. But I got to be honest, this is my reading of it. We'll still have to wait for what actually happens. I do have a lot of hope that we still will be very strong in just flat out requirement to be green, to be socially responsible. I do believe in the idea that it's a, you know, that procurement is a lot of money. It's a great instrument of governments to actually use and help our markets transition. But we have to treat public procurement as a market, and it's a market transition. It's not just a set of rules that government just put out and hope that, you know, companies will adapt. As an illustration, maybe one last thing I will say is I remember a conversation in Warsaw with the mayor of Warsaw who said, we do want to buy green. Now we put out a tender to buy green energy and to use, you know, green energy in the city. A great idea. You know, the end result of it is that the tender failed because the supply was not there. And they had to wait for another few years to actually be able to conduct that contract. So really, we should treat it as a tango between governments and market participants for the transition. We have to understand, well, what kind of ambition can we have in certain, you know, sectors? What kind of criteria will go far? And what sectors are a bit more premature? So it's much more nuanced than just putting a set of rules from the European Commission and hoping the countries will adapt to them.
Thank you. Can you tell us more about how you ended up in this world and what Open Contracting Partnership does?
Sure. You know, I was at the conference yesterday of 400 people, and I asked the question to everybody. I said, well, who of you dreamt of becoming a public procurement professional? There was zero hands, obviously. It's one of those professions that are very, it's perceived to be very administrative, very bureaucratic. But really what it is, it's one of the most powerful professions you can have at government, right? Because you control a lot of money that goes through your fingers, right? So it's interesting how it's one of those fields that it's difficult to understand. The perception is very bureaucratic, but it's very, very meaningful. And that's what we do. What we do at Open Contracting Partnership, which is a global nonprofit, is we help governments use procurement strategically. We want procurement to be better. We want procurement to be more strategic. We want it to deliver for people. And the way we do it is we combine the power of technology, the power of data, and public procurement as a policy tool to deliver that. So we work globally in all continents, in Africa, in Latin America, in Europe. And yeah, it seems to be going very well.
In the next part of our podcast, I want to come back to some of these trade-offs. Francesco and Marie, you say it so well in your paper. You talk about the trilemma of budgetary and price stability, getting value for money and taxpayer resources, strategic autonomy, making sure that people have control over the things they think are most essential, and decarbonization, making the planet greener and less of a threat to ongoing climate change. Is there a hierarchy of those? Do people have to prioritize them?
That's a very political question. I asked exactly the same question yesterday during the event, since we had representatives of the Commission and of the European Parliament. They told us, you do not really offer a clear-cut solution to the trilemma. And our answer was, yeah, it's for you to give this to us. It's not the responsibility of think tankers or researchers to identify political priorities. These are three eminent political priorities. What comes first needs to be decided by politicians. What we know and what we should do as researchers is to emphasize that there are inherent contradictions and tensions if we try to do all three simultaneously. It does not mean that we cannot try to pursue or find some sort of equilibrium between, let's say, the geopolitical objectives, decarbonization and price stability, but trying to do all three of them without coordinating the actions taken can lead to massive mistakes. So this said, I think it's important to realize that the problem becomes a bit more manageable if we follow what Carolis was saying before, that is splitting the dossier into smaller sectors, trying to look at what really is strategic, where certain solutions of the trilemma can be taken. Remember, in a trilemma, you can choose usually two of the options at the same time, not all three. So in some sectors, some direction can be taken, for instance, in favoring what we call the construction of lead markets, which means using public procurement to create European-wide supply chains. In other sectors, it's perhaps too late, and we should simply pursue decarbonization and price stability by importing Chinese supplies, which are great, they are very cheap, and in many ways allow us to proceed faster in decarbonization. So we need to be mindful and know the underlying industrial base that we face in Europe, that we have in Europe, to understand where there is potential to construct long-term green supply chains, and where instead it's much more useful to rely on readily available supply. I mean, for instance, on solar panels, in batteries, probably we should use, quite mature technology coming from abroad, while in fields like or sectors like steel, the EU has a green potential and we should invest on it.
Yeah, I would fully subscribe to what Francesco said as well. I would really also like to emphasize that it's really important to recognize that there really are these trade-offs. So what we, for example, also often heard in discussions that we had were in buildings, for example, that yes, buying green or sustainable building practices are more expensive upfront, but the life cycle cost is lower, which is 100% true, and which is also very important. But for a lot of public contracting authorities, also often just the buy price at that moment matters. Budgets are often at an annual basis. People have to adhere to certain criteria in terms of price, really. And even though it might be cheaper in the long term, there is also upfront costs that really need to be considered. And I think that in a lot of discussions, this is not 100% transparently discussed, or like I said, people kind of brush it aside without focusing on it. So that's why I also think that our paper really contributes to that in focusing a bit on the reality of things sometimes as well.
Carlos, how do you work through those? And are there other factors that people have to consider?
I think what Marie said in the beginning about the information and data is crucial, because the trilemma gives you a framework of the trade-offs and choices that you as a politician have to make. Now, the really worrying thing is that those type of discussions lately, and since the beginning really, have been based on ideological perceptions and sort of positions. What we at Open Contract and Partnership say is that get your data right, get your information down, and make these decisions based on data and information, right? And I have witnessed this also in the discussions in the European Parliament, where basically what you have one term of politicians, the previous one, you know, the Greens kind of promoting the green agenda. The way I look at it is that this is not really an ideological position, right? We should know whether green services or goods are cheaper or more expensive. We should know, you know, whether they are more expensive over the life cycle. We should know that before actually talking out from the standing point of the European Parliament and saying that green is more expensive. We don't know that for sure. And at least we have to get our definitions right. We don't even have a definition of green procurement. Some countries say, you know, you build a stadium, let's say, and you spend 5% or 10% of your budget with green criteria, you tick it off as a green project. That's greenwashing. We have to define what thresholds, you know, across the EU we apply to actually call things green, right? So disregarding what I think, you know, what the hierarchy should be, what I want to see is evidence and data-driven discussion about it, and then having a clear decision saying that, all right, right now we're building our strategic sectors, we might pay a bit more premium, and, you know, we might slow down on decarbonization for a bit until we develop the technologies, get more mature, and then we'll prioritize decarbonization. The price will get a bit more stable. You know, we will have our strategic sector developed and mature with green offer. That's the discussion I would like to have. But sadly, because we don't have data of public procurement, we don't know the prices, we don't collect it, we don't analyze it, we are left really a victims of ideological and discussions, you know, where we end up, where the louder voice wins. And that's not really the way it should be.
Are these conversations happening outside Europe, or is Europe really the only place that's making the green transition a priority for public purchasing decisions?
It's a global conversation for sure. There's a lot of excitement going on in Africa right now, especially in Northern Africa. There's a lot of excitement also in Latin America, in the Asia Pacific about green procurement. I do have to say that EU, though, is the leader and really a standard setter right now in terms of what kind of green criteria, in terms of the level of ambition. We do have some amazing examples like Lithuania, for example, my own country, that a few years ago decided to go all in with saying 100% of our procurement is going to be green in a span of 2 years. And they actually did it. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of quality issues there, a lot of implementation, all of that. But in terms of the ambition and in terms of the position that the government showed, that was actually great. You know, so Europe is still the source of best examples. The Europe is still the one kind of setting the global direction in this policy area. But the world is catching up. It's definitely interesting, you know, for most countries and for most continents as well.
Thank you. Francesco, I want to come back to strategic autonomy because you mentioned specifically using China as a supplier for green components. That is a reality of the global manufacturing environment. But China in particular is a very sensitive topic in Europe, particularly when it comes to infrastructure. How can we think through that in your view?
So infrastructure is typically what economists would call non-tradable goods, which in turn means that we do not really need to involve Chinese directly in order to decarbonize infrastructural construction, because it's not that they are going to ship cement from China. They would still need to source local supplies. Now, for steel is different, of course. I mean, steel is a very important component of infrastructure, and steel can and is shipped globally, but a lot of construction materials tend to be sourced, if not locally, at least nationally. So the Chinese involvement in infrastructure is really more a political question, once again, rather than a matter of decarbonization.
But what about solar panels and what about telecommunications?
Yeah, so instead, when we're not talking about infrastructure in the sense of constructions and buildings, but rather energy technology, then of course, the Chinese are the world producer of solar panels, and their contribution to decarbonization at a world scale is really very important. I mean, we can downplay in many ways what China is doing. They're still one of the countries which is adding coal capacity at a very high rate, but they are also adding basically an equivalent of EU-level solar panels every 2 or 3 years. Their technology is both very cheap, readily available, and for now not object of any export controls, which is instead the case for different type of Chinese technology right now, especially those with dual use. So there is really no reason why we should not use this type of technology if our priority, and again, this is a political question, if our priority is decarbonizing, then I don't see why we should refrain from using some Chinese technology. There are other reasons why we would like to make sure that we develop our own supply chains. But for things like solar panels and probably batteries, right now is a bit too late. Now, solar panels are, I would say, a prime case where we should be more open and accept, even welcome the price advantage of Chinese products. Batteries are a dual-use product. They are important not just for decarbonization, they are important for all sorts of things, including defense purposes. So on batteries, there is a logic, which once again is strategic, is political, which suggests we might want to have ensured supply, but solar panels are essential for decarbonization. Rebuilding the entire supply chain, as a paper by our colleagues here at Bruegel has shown last year, would have a massive cost, which then would really slow down decarbonization.
Marie, is there a rubric or a framework that governments can use to work through this?
We, in our paper, kind of look at this from different angles in terms of how you can use public procurement specifically to achieve different goals that are in relation to this. So we, for example, talk about how you could introduce green criteria, for example, into the public procurement process, which you could do, for example, at a product level. So you could say, okay, certain products fulfill the criteria that we wanted to fulfill. This could be green. This could also have the European content, for example. And these products are then either eligible, or if products have these certain criteria, they get a higher weight, for example, in contracting decisions. So there's different mechanisms that you can go through in this regulation. And we kind of iterate through these different combinations. So either you go at a product level or at a company level, so whether companies are eligible to apply for different tenders, or whether certain companies with certifications would be favored, together with a combination of, like I said, so either this eligibility criterion, so can companies basically be in the pool of bidders in the first place, or whether it's a bit more on the awarding side, so in a way that if you fulfill certain criteria, you're more likely to get the contract. So we iterate through this a little bit, in particular on the green case, and what advantages and disadvantages different combinations of this have. For example, if the goal would be lead market creation, so we've talked about this a little bit already. So if you want to build your own supply chains or your own industries in strategic areas, what would be the best combination to achieve this? So this is one example. But like Francesco also said, it really just depends on your political priorities as well. So what do you think is more important? And this can differ across sectors. So if you talk about the construction sector or the energy sector or whatnot.
Yeah, so indeed, in the paper, we developed this matrix, if you will, where we look at criteria that are at product level or company level, and then eligibility level or award level. And each of these combinations that really has pros and cons, right? If you go for some combinations, you probably get advantages and disadvantages in developing lead markets, but also in terms of simplification. Imagine you have product level criteria combined with award criteria, so giving a weight to green components or green criteria in the award. This would be great if your goal is to create a lead market, all right? At the same time, it makes things extremely complicated if you generalize it, because public procurers procure thousands, tens of thousands of different products. And for each of them, you would need specific rules, EU-wide. So there is a clear tension between the objective of creating lead markets and another objective of the European Union, that is simplification. So it's important to keep in mind that each of these combinations create advantages and costs. And in the paper, we go through it quite a bit.
I do want to very quickly chip in into this one. I do think the frameworks are very, very useful, especially when governments don't exactly know what they want to do. And think tanks are very, very helpful in proposing some kind of frameworks. But in many situations, government instinctively or maybe even explicitly know what they want to do and what they want to promote. I'll give you an example. In a country where we helped develop green criteria, they are now developing a bus company, electric bus company. And with all the internal market principles forgotten, they asked us to create a criteria that would create a preferential treatment for their local bus company. And I understand the government for wanting to promote their internal business after, especially you probably, some of the listeners maybe will be aware of the case in Belgium where a Chinese bus company won the tender and the local electric bus company went bankrupt. That's a bit of a problem. So when we, what I see and what I witness working directly with governments on developing criteria and certification schemes is that governments know what they want to do and they play the rules a bit to, you know, to secure their markets and to be protectionist in a way, which would have been a value crime a few years ago. But lately, it seems to be the case that the Commission actually starts to understand that the supply chains have to be a bit shorter. You know, they're kind of, we are even explicitly saying that one of our values or goals of procurement reform will be buy European, you know, and so the whole kind of perception of what procurement should exactly do and what kind of opportunities it should create, especially from practitioners and government level conversations I hear, are becoming much more protectionist, and green procurement is also being used as an instrument to actually protect your own markets. I'm not passing a judgment here. I'm just saying what I'm hearing from some of the governments we work with.
In the last part of our podcast, I think we really need to talk about budgets. Where does the money come from to buy stuff? And I'd love to hear more from each of you about these tremendous political pressures that Carolus was just telling us about.
Yeah, thanks for the question. We discussed this in the paper and also in several of the events that covered this issue of public procurement in the past months. And of course, the issue here is that the moment you introduce qualitative criteria in public procurement, you also give political decision makers the opportunity to favor friends and local companies. It's something that, you know, we saw many times in the past years, especially in the past decades, and it was somehow prohibited or became much less of a standard after the Single European Act in 1986. It is coming back now because we are introducing qualitative criteria. So it's essential that whichever reform that introduces qualitative assessment and not just pricing does so in ways that remain very transparent. Now, a key point is also the what we call the local available supply. So how many producers actually have the capacity of bidding for a certain tender at the local level? Because ultimately, the great majority of tenders ends up being local public administrations that receive money from the government, but they procure locally. Why it is important even for this sort of political gaming? Because when you have a lot of international players or a lot of players competing for a tender, they sort of act as self-watchdogs of what is going on. They keep each other in check. But if there are only two or three local players, it's much easier for a politician to select ex-ante winners. So having proper EU-wide rules allow companies to bid for many tenders, which increases the local available supply, which in turn means that companies keep each other in check. Now, let me come to the second point of your question, that is pricing. We discussed this very extensively in the paper. The risk of green procurement, if done in ways that are too protectionist, is that it will drive costs for taxpayers up, because ultimately is the government which has to, you know, pay for this, which means taxpayers. So in the paper, we discuss with great detail the sources of potential increments in costs associated with public procurement, with green public procurement. And of course, part of it is inherent additional qualities. It costs more to produce better things, and we really cannot do anything about that. But part of it is, again, lack of scale. You know, we all know that in most industrial products, scale is fundamental. Producing small number of units is extremely expensive, while producing at a scale produces much lower costs. No, classical economies of scale argument. And here again, last thing I say, it's important we have comparable, if not a single rule book, comparable rule books across Europe, because the moment we have a whole European rule book, companies can basically propose the same products across the entire European Union, which allows them to scale up. In this case, it's essential, because if we don't scale up, the costs are going to be extensive.
I want to jump in here super quickly and really also reemphasize the point that Francesco made on transparency. So we also have some results of a survey that Francesco has conducted. There is actually a lot of public support for green procurement, even if it costs more. Now, of course, this is a survey question in a way. So whether if this would be coupled with direct tax increases, for example, the question is on how strong that is. But in principle, people aren't against this in terms of governments paying more for better quality, for example, or greener products. What I think is super important and why I want to reemphasize this transparency point is really with current political shifts in Europe, with more anti-green sentiment as well, I think it's just really important that if criteria like green criteria are introduced, that it really comes with a lot of transparency that can be also, because ultimately it is taxpayers' money, be justified to taxpayers why my local authority built a school that costs X percent more when there was a cheaper tender out there, and that these criteria are really also not only accessible for the general public, but also, of course, for procuring authorities who ultimately have to make the decisions. But so the transparency point is a really good one, a really important one.
Francesca, when you say European standards, do you mean specifically procurement standards, or do you just mean generally the more things are standardized, the easier it is for people to buy them in organized ways?
No, I mean, there is a general point. That is, in general, rule books and regulations are a more effective way of dealing with policies. Although, I mean, one could also say that giving flexibility to national governments in implementing some rules may allow them to tailor their decisions to the realities of their local markets. But it's important for companies to be sure that whichever government they want to do business with will apply a similar set of rules. So one of the recommendations we give in the paper is that if, as it looks like, a very encompassing, very broad public procurement reform is going to be put forward by the Commission in the next year or so, they keep delaying it, by the way, but if this is going to happen, then we really suggest to use as much as possible regulations as an instrument rather than directives, because directives are great on paper, but then they take a lot of years for implementation. Countries have a lot of flexibility and a lot of time. So often it takes up to 7 or 8 years on average for implementing acts at national level. And this is something that is too long. Now, not only is it too long for the green transition, but it's also too long for companies which have now to make a decision as of whether to invest in scaling up green steel or green cement or product lines, not knowing whether 10 years down the road, the criteria will be equivalent between France and, say, Germany or Italy, means that these companies are going to delay for 10 years their investments. So regulations, whenever possible, is absolutely essential.
Enrico Letta also makes that point a lot, coming on his report on the single market. But Carolus, what do you make of all this?
No, absolutely. I agree with both Francesco and Marie. We do need as much clarity as possible. The European Commission has been very blurry with its green procurement regulations. There has been a combination of, you know, what you call a horizontal and vertical sort of legal instrument. So for some sectors, it has been clarified, like for public administration buildings, for transport, for clean vehicles. It has been pretty clear and it has worked very well for vehicles, for example, you know. For some, it has been left blurry. So one of the aspirations of the green movement right now is just make things clear. And one of the best ideas out there is consolidating all legal instruments into one comprehensive regulation that would make the rule book unified, as Francesco says it. And that would help. And I also... intellectually, you want to kind of reason that, yes, maybe not everybody is ready. It's going to take time, different market maturities in Czech Republic or Sweden, you know, and things like that. Sure. But what I would also like to bring in the conversation is the human/political element here. In countries where I have seen more courage just to go through quickly a rapid transition, it has actually worked. You know, a lot of the beasts and myths are busted very quickly when the market is confronted with a rule, achievable rule, but still with a rule and regulation, and they have to comply if they want to sell to a government. That has been the case in the Baltics. It has been the case in Italy with the first country proposing a mandatory green criteria in some sectors. And it has worked. Has it been painful? Yeah. Has it worked? Yes, in the end. So I do think that legal regulation is essential. Clear regulation from the European Commission would help green transition. So I can only agree with that point.
Yes. And if I can come back to what you just said, the human element, I think it's essential. At the moment, it's so complex, the entire legal setup. We have, I mean, maybe Carolis will correct me, but there is one main directive. There are like 10 or more sectoral directives and then an enormous amount of regulations. And this even before we start going into national implementing acts, national rules, and so on. It's 600 legal texts in total. So simplification here is key, but as long as along with simplification, we also need, and we emphasize this in the paper, training. Training for local public administrations is essential because people cannot cope in small municipalities, in small government offices, in schools, cannot cope with constantly changing rules at this scale. So the commission actually here, they are already doing something. They are put forward training seminars, often online, but not only for local public administrations. One thing that we think is very important, also in view of the negotiations of the on the next budget, on the next multi-annual financial framework, is to have some space for procurement capacity construction. So we need to invest on the public administrations to train, you know, government procurement officers on whichever new common rule book will result of this broad reform. This also, by the way, will bring, you know, together an effort in unifying, in coordinating local public administrations, which has, in my opinion, huge long-term advantages in the way the European Union will work.
Can I very quickly, Francesco, just echo something you said and also chip in with a bit of hope here? Because the professionalization agenda of public procurers in the EU has been very strategic, very important, but it's so hard to do. You have thousands and thousands of procurement officers out there, and we are kind of relying on their skill and their expertise, very often low-paid government bureaucrats, to do the right choice when it comes to environment decisions, socially responsible decision, the best, you know, market consultation they have to do. They have to know the prices. The hope and the expectation on their shoulders is just too huge. What I think and where I see a source of hope is that what we need to train a bit more and where we need to spend a bit more money in is training AI tools. I do see a lot of potential of artificial intelligence, especially in capacity of procurement officers, because the whole shift in the skill of public procurement, I think, will be shifting from knowing the amount of information and storing the amount of information in your head into a different skill set, which is making decision and juggling that information to get the best goods or service from the market. You can. So I would very much, you know, welcome a bit more conversations in the European Commission and European Parliament about the potential of AI and actually this specific elements of capacity to procure, which I do think is a very, very near future. We will have fantastic AI tools. And we at Open Contract and Partnership have already been experimenting with using AI for green procurement, where discovering and identifying green criteria takes a millisecond. And then thinking about it, reflecting and choosing whether to use it for your own individual contract is a whole different matter. But that discovery moment is very important, you know, to have that knowledge at your fingertips. I do think there's huge change coming in the next few years in that regard.
Marie, any last thoughts on what you want listeners to take away from this work and these issues?
Yeah, so maybe if I, try to summarize a very, very broad discussion, which is going to be very difficult, I think, because we touched on a lot of topics. But I think also going back to a point that has been mentioned a few times now is really try and get an overview of good data, make informed decisions based on that data, and yeah, kind of be aware of different consequences the decisions can have. So this was a very broad summary, but just going back to our trilemma discussion in terms of really understanding the trade-offs that are out there.
Thanks very much. Listeners can find the full paper in the show notes and on the Bruegel website for free at Bruegel.org. We will also link to the events that people were talking about. We're recording this on September the 25th, and this week earlier, there were events by all the participants of this conversation that relate to this discussion. You've been listening to The Sound of Economics from Bruegel. I'm Rebecca Christie, joined today with Marie-Sophie Lapa, Francesco Nicoli, and Carolis Granitzkas. Thanks so much. See you next time.